Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two had a busy touring year in 1955, made more difficult because of their commitment to the Louisiana Hayride. Almost every Saturday night, they had to be in Shreveport, Louisiana, a 700-mile round trip from Memphis. In his first 2 years of touring, Cash clocked over 100,000 miles of road travel. At the Hayride, Cash befriended Johnny Horton, another regular on the show. Like Cash, Horton had a keen intellect and loved outdoor pursuits. Before turning professional, he'd studied at the University of Seattle and had worked as a fisherman in Alaska. He was such an expert at casting with a rod and reel that the Fred Abergas Company paid him to do demonstrations. His favorite trick, one that greatly impressed Cash, was to attach a sugar lump to his line and cast it into a cup of coffee 15 yards away. Although by 1956 Horton had only had one hit, Honky Tonk Man, he considerably raised his profile by marrying Billie Jean, the extraordinarily beautiful dark-haired widow of Hank Williams. Hank, divorced by his wife Audrey in May 1952, had taken up with the then 19-year-old Billie Jean Jones Eschlemar. Already married and separated once, she was dating country star Farron Young when Hank met her backstage at the Opry. Though she had come to see Young's debut, Hank reportedly told her, "If you ain't married, old Hank's gonna marry you. You're about the purtiest thing I ever saw." On October 19, 1952, he did just that, in a lavish public ceremony on stage at the New Orleans Municipal Auditorium. 3 months later, Hank was dead and she was the widow of a legend. In September 1953, Billie Jean married Horton, guaranteeing him the spotlight. "She had Johnny Horton wrapped around her finger," says Marshall Grant. "She was a gorgeous, gorgeous woman who knew how to dress the part. Johnny Horton was a very plain, straightforward type of guy, and you could say that they were mismatched. What held the marriage together, I have no earthly idea. Absolutely none." Horton believed in the powers of the supernatural. Although raised in a fundamentalist Christian home in Tyler, Texas, Horton's curiosity about the paranormal had led him to investigate hypnosis, mind reading, dream analysis, automatic writing, and spiritualism. Some people dismissed him as a charlatan, while others were frightened by his claims to be able to predict events, move objects through mind control, and see spirits. Horton's favorite party trick while on the road was hypnotizing band members and coaxing them into uncharacteristic behaviors. He once put Cash into a trance and urged him to explore childhood memories. When he came to, he had the words of a new song. Horton had been drawn into spiritualism by J. Bernard Ricks, a local postal worker who came to the Hayride offering to enhance the creativity of the performers by unleashing spiritual power. Merle Kilgore, a songwriter, he wrote Webb Pierce's 1954 hit More and More, and neighbor of Horton's, believes that Horton influenced Cash in this area. "He called me one day when Johnny Horton was out of town and came over to see me and my wife," he says. "We went into my music room that had album covers on the walls, and he said it felt so relaxed. My wife brought him coffee, and he said, 'If you don't mind, I'm going to close my eyes and meditate.' Then we heard this tremendous pop. The ceiling had split. My wife and I just looked up, and he said, 'Oh, I'm sorry. I just ruined your new music room.' I said, 'How did you do that?' He joked, 'Just meditating. I got the power too strong.'" The national success of I Walk the Line increased the demand for Cash to play concerts outside the South, so he found himself traveling to Colorado and Arizona, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Minnesota. In December 1956, he toured California, and in April 1957 took a 24-day tour of Canada, his first time on stage outside the U.S., except for shows in Landsberg, Germany. In the smaller venues, Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two appeared alone, but on the concert tours they played with many of the top names in country entertainment. Legends like George Jones, Jim Reeves, Farron Young, Patsy Cline, and Ray Price. Cash's manager Bob Neal ran a Memphis-based agency called Stars Incorporated, which represented many Sun artists. Although he had lost Elvis to Colonel Tom Parker in 1957, he still counted Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, Roy Orbison, Sonny James, and Warren Smith among his clients. If a tour promoter wanted to book Johnny Cash or Carl Perkins, Neal could put together an attractive package by including other artists on his books. The California tour, which started in Salinas, was booked by a young Santa Barbara-based promoter named Stu Carnall, who'd become interested in Cash after hearing Hey Porter playing on a jukebox in Phoenix, Arizona. Carnall came from a wealthy family and had been educated in the best schools. Well-spoken, Carnall had cultivated tastes and drove an Eldorado convertible. He believed that there was an untapped market for country music in the central farmlands of California, which were filled with Midwesterners who'd migrated westward in the 1930s and 1940s. The California dates were unlike anything Cash had played in the South. Instead of concert halls, he and the Tennessee Two performed in large ballrooms in towns like Modesto, Vallejo, and Niles, where the opening act usually consisted of a country band playing dance music. Ralph J. Gleason, the most perceptive pop cultural commentator of the period and later the inspiration behind the founding of Rolling Stone magazine, attended one of the California shows. An early champion of the beat poets, Bob Dylan, and San Francisco psychedelic rock, Gleason was one of the first critics to treat popular music as an art form rather than as mere entertainment. In the December 16, 1956 edition of the San Francisco Chronicle, he wrote, "During the past week, Cash has been playing one-nighters in California, and if the reaction of the crowd at the performances is any indication, Presley has a rival. Like Elvis, Johnny Cash sings and strums a guitar, but unlike Presley, there are no bumps and grinds in his routine. He is a fair to middling country guitar player himself and composed the words and music to the first four tunes he recorded." Although the California tour lasted for only 10 dates, Carnall liked Johnny's act so much that he negotiated with Bob Neal to buy 50% of his management contract for $5,000, plus 7% of Cash's next annual gross. Neal would continue to manage the business side from his base in Memphis, and Carnall would, in effect, become tour manager, handling the day-to-day business on the road. Naturally, as Cash's popularity grew, the touring intensified. He also appeared on TV shows such as Country Style USA and Ranch Party, and made a 10-show commitment to the Jackie Gleason Show. After returning from his 24-day tour of Canada in May 1957, he complained to Ted Freeman about the stress of his schedule. "I'm 26 pounds lighter and 10 years older. We averaged 420 miles per day, and I am tired and sick." There were no tour buses, personal assistants, road crews, or short hop flights for touring artists in those days. All travel was by road, and since the interstate network hadn't yet been constructed, this meant slow driving down two-lane blacktops. Because of the many long distances between gigs, they often drove at night, taking turns at the wheel. If they were lucky, they'd arrive at the motel early enough to catch a nap. In July 1957, while touring Florida with Patsy Cline, Ray Price, Ferlin Husky, Farron Young, and Hank Thompson, Cash first encountered the overworked traveling performer's panacea, the drug amphetamine. The small tablets, which immediately increased alertness, could be obtained legitimately with a prescription. Not only could the drug sharpen the senses while banishing tiredness, but it could sustain an all-night songwriting session or add some sparkle to an after-show party. To many country stars of the 1950s, amphetamine seemed like a blessing.